cowardly, the Republicans who voted to spare Trump on procedural grounds and said she would refuse to entertain their calls for a censure. "We censure people for using stationery for the wrong purpose," she said, her voice rising in indignation. "We don't censure people for inciting insurrection." Just moments after the not guilty verdict was announced, a defiant Donald Trump thanked Republicans who stood by him and decried what he called yet another phase of the greatest witch hunt in the history of our country. In his statement, Donald Trump expressed no remorse and made no mention of the violence that unfolded in his name on Wednesday, 6th of January, but signaled his desire to remain a political force within the Republican Party. "Our historic, patriotic, and beautiful movement to make America great again has only just begun," he declared triumphantly. Donald Trump is the first U.S. president to be impeached twice and is now the first president to be twice acquitted. The decision leaves him free to pursue another tilt at the White House in 2024, though opinion polls suggest the violent end of his presidency left his reputation badly damaged. The House of Representatives impeached Trump in his final days in office on one charge of incitement of insurrection of the siege on the U.S. Capitol. He invited supporters to Washington on the day Electoral College votes were being counted, told them to fight like hell, and encouraged them to go to the U.S. Capitol, Democrats charged. Once the attack on the Capitol turned deadly, placing Vice President Mike Pence, members of Congress, and Capitol Hill employees in danger, Donald Trump violated his oath of office by failing to defend the U.S. government against the attack, the impeachment article alleged. The attack came after Donald Trump spent weeks trying to overturn the results of the November 2020 election. Five people died as a direct result of the assault, including a police officer, and scores of others were seriously injured. During the two-day presentation, prosecutors played harrowing and never-before-seen security footage of the attack to bolster their case that Donald Trump had deliberately fomented insurrection by whipping up his followers who believed they were acting on his instructions. Crucially, they argued, the Capitol siege was not just a result of the speech Donald Trump gave on Wednesday, 6th of January, but a foreseeable result after he spent years sanctioning violence among his supporters. In a chamber protesters breached, the Democrats' case was by turns emotional and visceral. It offered new insight into the scope of the violence that transpired, and senators learned for the first time how close the nation's political leaders came to the mob that haunted them. The striking evidence presented was a notable contrast to Trump's first impeachment trial, which was built around documents and testimony regarding his effort to pressure Ukrainian officials to help him politically. After Democrats concluded their arguments, Trump's lawyers used just a fraction of the 16 hours allocated for their case. They used a smattering of approaches, arguing Trump could not be tried because he had already left office and that his speech did not amount to an incitement of violence and was protected by the First Amendment. During their brief presentation on Friday, 12th of February, Trump's lawyers argued that he was using the same kind of rhetoric politicians frequently use, and said the trial was a political witch hunt and that Trump was a victim of constitutional cancel culture. Those arguments largely seemed to be an effort to distort the case against Trump and obscure the unique context under which he encouraged his supporters to disrupt the activities of the U.S. government as it facilitated the peaceful transfer of power. The vote on Saturday, 13th of February, came after the proceedings were briefly thrown into chaos when the House managers unexpectedly moved to call witnesses in an effort to shed light on Trump's state of mind as the assault unfolded on the Capitol building. Caught off guard, Trump's legal team threatened to depose at least over 100 witnesses and said Nancy Pelosi was at the top of their list. After a frantic bout of uncertainty in which it appeared the manager's request could prolong the trial for several more weeks, senators struck a deal with the prosecution and Trump's lawyers to avert calling witnesses. Instead, they agreed to enter as evidence the written statement of a Republican congresswoman who had been told that Donald Trump sided with the rioters after the House Minority Leader pleaded with him to stop the attack on Wednesday, 6th of January. Embracing Trump's combative and fact-bending approach, his lawyers declared him innocent of the charges against him and denounced the trial as a final desperate attempt by Democrats to disqualify their most despised opponent from public office. "You do not have to indulge the impeachment lust, the dishonesty and the hypocrisy," Michael Van der Veen, one of Donald Trump's lawyers, told senators. With the result a foregone conclusion, the Democratic managers summoned the weight of history, reminding senators of the consequential votes taken by their forebearers in the same chamber, from abolishing slavery to passing the Civil Rights Act and imposing sanctions on apartheid South Africa. Difficult in the moment, the managers said, these votes defined their legacies and changed the course of American history. "There are moments that transcend party politics and that require us to put country above our political party, because the consequences of not doing so are just too great," said one of the House managers, Joe Neguse. Neguse added, "Senators, this is one such moment."
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we looked at how the ongoing epidemic of men's violence in America is rooted in this inability as a society to move beyond outmoded ideals of manhood. In a sweeping analysis that cut across racial, ethnic, and class lines, we examined mass shootings, day-to-day gun violence, violence against women, bullying, and American militarism against the backdrop of a culture that has normalized violent and regressive forms of masculinity in the face of challenges to traditional male power and authority. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
It turns out that Lord Baden-Powell bonded the Boy Scout for a very explicit reason, to counteract what he perceived as a decline in the manly virtues. In his influential book, Rovering to Success, A Guide to Young Manhood, Powell was quite explicit about this. "God made men to be men," he wrote. "Civilization, with its town life, buses, hot and cold water laid on, everything done for you, tends to make men soft and feckless beings. We badly need training for our lads if we are to keep up manliness in our race instead of lapsing into a nation of soft, sloppy cigarette suckers."
The Scout program is designed to help our sons, cousins, and younger brothers develop the initiative, the resourcefulness, the character, the quick thinking, and the leadership they really need in the somewhat jittery, insecure world in which we live.
Again and again at key moments in American history, you see men reacting to change in just this way by retreating into a hyper-masculine fantasy world. You see it in the rise of popular men's magazines in the 1940s, filled with stories about breathtaking manly adventures in sports. These magazines may look retro to us today, but what's important to remember is that they were just as retro in their own time. As the lives of men grew more sedentary during the consumer boom of the post-war years, as women moved into the workplace in unprecedented numbers and the women's movement gained traction, these magazines offered men a way to hit back at what Ralph Day, the editorial director of True Magazine, describes as the perils of creeping equality. Men were turning to his magazine in unprecedented numbers, Day explained to a group of men in a speech, because it stimulates his masculine ego at a time when man wants to fight back against women's efforts to usurp his traditional role as head of the family. And this backlash has only accelerated exponentially since the 1960s, when the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and the anti-war movement rose up to challenge traditional masculine authority like never before, especially the authority of straight white men.
Plain truth of the matter is, this has to stop, and it has to stop like the day before yesterday.
Feminism was established so that unattractive, ugly broads could have easy access to the mainstream, right? Did you see it? Yes!
Look at our political culture, where the game is all about establishing your manly credentials by butching yourself up and methodically feminizing and taking apart the manhood of your opponents.
And to those critics who are so pessimistic about our economy, I say, don't be economic girly man.
There was no clearer depiction of this backlash phenomenon than the film Fight Club. The movie portrayed the emasculation of young men by the consumer culture.
We're still men.
Yes, we're men. Men is what we are.
And offered up bare-knuckled violence as a way for men to reclaim their manhood. Regardless of whether we see film as a glamorization or a satire of backlash masculinity, backyard fight clubs have proliferated in the years since the film's release. And at the base of all of this is the belief that the best way for men to restore their dwindling manhood and restore order is through what the cultural historian Richard Slotkin has called the frontier myth of regenerative violence.
Most people understand that guns make you safer, especially because society is degenerating. There's going to be a lot of craziness going on. And so we need guns to protect ourselves.
To older working and middle-class white men, the message is clear.
That's the thing that gets me. If I lived on the border and some brown man came running through my backyard that looks like he didn't belong there, then why aren't people doing that?
The basic idea is that the best way to regain power and control is through a barrel of a gun, or as many guns as possible.
They're accurate. They are dependable.
Yes, they are. Super dependable.
They are extremely well made. You can carry plenty of them on your person at all times.
This white male paranoia and siege mentality have fueled the increasingly aggressive effort to block even the most sensible gun policies.
When the system is overwhelmed, and I mean the system on the entire planet, somebody had better be prepared to protect themselves, their families, their neighborhoods, and the freedom of all mankind. Never let them take your Second Amendment right, ever.
This siege mentality has also fueled the rise of hate groups and militias over the past quarter century.
They're not branches of Al-Qaeda. They're right-wing extremists with lots of guns and an axe to grind against the U.S. government.
Listen, people. Things are bad. Things are real bad. And it's going to get a lot worse. So basically, if people need to wake up, start buying some of these, see?
Groups like these are often described as white supremacist hate groups, which they usually are. But they can also be seen as a kind of reactionary men's movement, an organized expression of white male anxiety and aggrieved entitlement that relies on violence as the preferred means of attaining its goals.
Recovery crews are still searching the waters around an island where a gunman opened fire on young people attending a summer camp.
In recent years, perhaps the most disgusting and morally bankrupt expression of this kind of threatened entitlement was the massacre of 77 people, including 69 teenagers, perpetrated by the Norwegian right-wing fanatic Anders Breivik, a former customer service representative who had been declared unfit for service in the Norwegian army. In his 1,500-page manifesto explaining his reasons for the attack, Breivik ranted against culturalism, but he reserved special venom for feminism's role in emasculating Western men. According to Breivik, feminist ideology and political correctness have been responsible for transforming a patriarchy into a matriarchy and intend to deny the intrinsic worth of males. And by now, men have been reduced to an emasculated, touchy-feely subspecies. What this shows is that a whole lot of men out there fear they're losing control and are turning to violence to reclaim their manhood. In his fascinating study of violence, the psychiatrist James Gilligan interviewed hundreds of violent criminals in American prisons and found that the single most powerful reason they turned to violence was because they felt shamed, humiliated, or disrespected as men. The more time I spent with him, Gilligan writes about one of the hundreds of violent criminals he has interviewed over the course of his research, the clearer it became that his character served as a defense against the threat of being treated with scorn and disrespect, of being perceived as a weakling, not a real man, someone who could be laughed at. We may not hear about it much in mainstream coverage of violence, but again and again we've seen exactly this dynamic. Young men using violence to overcome the shame of not being seen and respected as real men.
16-year-old Luke Woodham entered the commons area of Pearl High and fired off several shots.
Woodham opened fire at Pearl High School, killing two students.
Consider Luke Woodham, who carried out a school shooting in Pearl, Mississippi in the late 1990s. Woodham wrote a letter before he went on his rampage explaining himself this way. I am not insane, I am angry. I killed because people like me are mistreated every day. All throughout my life, I was ridiculed, always beaten, always hated. If I can't do it through pacifism, if I can't show you through the displaying of intelligence, then I will do it with a bullet. Murder is not weak and slow-witted. Murder is gutsy and daring.
Just minutes after firing two fatal shots at the Virginia Tech dormitory on Monday, Cho Sung-hui returned to his own dorm room and made the final preparations to mail what appears to be a video confession.
Or consider Sung-hee Cho, who committed one of the worst mass shootings in American history when he went on a shooting spree at Virginia Tech University in 2007, killing 32 people. Cho was a socially isolated, troubled young man with a history of mental health problems who had clearly bought into a cultural narrative that says the way to reclaim manhood is through projecting an image of menace and toughness, instilling fear in others, and using violence. Before he committed the Virginia Tech massacre, he wrote, produced, and starred in his own video, demonstrating how thoroughly he bought into this Hollywood script. Cho isn't the only mass murderer whose violent actions enabled him to rewrite the script of his life in order to place himself back in the manly starring role.
All you hear is like firecrackers, and then I looked out the window, and there's a kid with a trench coat and a shotgun throwing pipe bombs in the parking lot.
The Columbine killers, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, left behind written diaries that provide insight into how their murder of 12 classmates and a teacher was part of a conscious strategy to settle scores. In his journal, Klebold writes that he and Harris will take revenge on society.
The shooter was 36-year-old Andrew Engeldinger, an employee of the small company who had recently lost his job.
And this isn't just about young men. Again and again, we've seen the same thing with older men who commit mass shootings.
A troubled ex-husband is under arrest in a Southern California hair salon shooting that left 8 people dead.
In case after case, these men have faced grief, bitter disappointment, and feelings of failure.
The shooter, Richard Farley, was obsessed with a female colleague. He had also been laid off.
They are either chronically unemployed, have been left by their wives or girlfriends, been fired from their jobs, or have suffered some other kind of serious blow to their self-worth as men. Nothing can excuse the pathetic and cowardly way men like these use violence and destroy the lives of innocent people to make some kind of a statement. But we're kidding ourselves if we think these killings will stop unless and until we can identify and transform the larger cultural belief systems that underlie them.
From the mass shooting in Tucson aimed at former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords to the Colorado movie theater massacre, killers in many recent mass killings suffered mental illness.
Of course, there's no question that mental illness has played a role in a lot of rampage killings and mass shootings. But what never seems to get discussed is why it is that somewhere around 98% of school shootings and rampage killings have been committed by men, even though there are plenty of young women who suffer from mental illness as well. What this tells us is that violence can't be reduced to mental illness on its own, especially since the vast majority of mentally ill people are not violent at all. The bottom line is that even men who are mentally ill live and operate within a culture that has normalized violent masculinity and defined manhood in exceedingly narrow ways.
It's been widely reported school shooter Adam Lanza suffered some kind of personality disorder.
The Sandy Hook Elementary school shooter Adam Lanza may have been mentally ill, but he played out a familiar script.
He was bullied severely, brutally bullied, when he was in elementary school at Sandy Hook.
By all accounts, he was a socially awkward boy who didn't fit in and appears to have been mercilessly bullied.
That's a clip of the video game Call of Duty. It's also the game that Adam Lanza used to play.
He developed a revenge fantasy, secured firearms, and then killed his own mother before carrying out one of the most brutal and ruthless mass killings in American history. And in his own delusional and twisted way, he would recapture the sense of respect that seemed to have eluded him his whole life. The children of Newtown, like so many other innocent victims of men's violence, became theatrical props in the performance of an aggrieved, angry, and likely self-hating young man who absorbed all the wrong lessons about what it means to be a tough, strong man from the world around him. Just take a look at the ad campaign the Bushmaster Firearms Company ran prior to the Newtown Massacre for the very AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle Lanza used during his killing spree. What all of this amounts to is that our violence problem seems to be a lot less about lone wolves and monsters who fail to conform to society's norms than it is about too many men, in a sense, over-conforming to our norms and ideals of manhood out of fear of not being seen as men. When we talk about men's violence and dominant ideals of violent masculinity, there's a temptation to frame things in terms of the damage men do to others. But we need to look also at the devastating harm these norms do to men themselves. This is certainly true of gun violence. Every year in this country, over 30,000 people are killed by guns, something like 85 per day. The vast majority of these victims are men, approximately 86%. But while we're used to thinking about gun violence in terms of mass shootings and urban crime, we really don't talk a lot about how most gun deaths are the result of men and boys shooting themselves. Suicide, which is really violence turned inward, accounts for close to two-thirds of all gun deaths. The vast majority of people who kill themselves with a gun are men, and white men comprise over 80% of these firearm suicides. Violence doesn't just leave physical scars. It also leaves emotional scars. Look at the cost to African-American boys and young men of living in and around violence. Violence is the leading cause of death of African-American men between the ages of 15 and 30. But they also have much higher than average rates of depression, school dropout, mental health problems linked to perpetual stress, substance abuse. And just look at the terrible toll violence has taken on the psyches of men who serve in combat zones.
In the 5 years between 2006 and 2009, more than 1,100 members of the armed services took their own lives.
Something like half of U.S. service members who have done tours in Iraq and Afghanistan have signs of trauma, depression, flashbacks, alcohol and drug problems. In her landmark study, Trauma and Recovery, Judith Herman draws a powerful connection between the experience of male combat veterans and women who are the victims of domestic and sexual violence. The sources of the violence and their context might vary, but the unifying theme is that human beings, young and old, women and men, suffer when their physical and sexual boundaries are violated. But in the case of men, this pain gets compounded by a cultural belief system that equates manhood with invulnerability and ridicules and shames men who admit to being in emotional pain. In his classic work, I Don't Want to Talk About It, the therapist Terry Real identifies the widespread phenomenon of what he calls covert depression, a condition that roughly three-quarters of American men suffer in silence out of fear of seeming like less than a real man. For many of these men, childhood trauma and other experiences of violence play a role in this depression, which then can affect not only their ability to take care of themselves physically and emotionally, but also hinder their ability to sustain healthy relationships in adult life. Despite predictable arguments that equate trying to understand or prevent violence with weakness, the bottom line is that we have to have the strength to ask these kind of questions if we want to move beyond the never-ending cycle of violence. And that starts with examining the dominant stories we tell ourselves as a culture about manhood and violence and demanding more honest and accurate representations of the personal and societal consequences of violent masculinity. War movies like Saving Private Ryan showed not only the awe-inspiring courage of the men who stormed the beaches in Normandy and fought totalitarianism during World War II. The film also captured the panic, anxiety, and sheer terror of the young men who experienced that war.
There's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it. I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
More recently, The Hurt Locker explored another devastating effect of battlefield trauma, showing how the intensity and violence of war make it difficult for many veterans to adjust back to civilian life. And we saw the same kind of honest and tragic portrayal of dominant masculinity in the film The Wrestler, starring Mickey Rourke as an over-the-hill professional wrestler whose body was ravaged by physical injury and who was so emotionally damaged by violence that he couldn't imagine life outside the glamour of the arena. Intensely realistic shows like HBO's The Wire have refused to glamorize urban street life and violent crime, directly confronting the costs young men of color too often pay for their investment in the idea that respect comes only at the business end of a Glock. And we've seen emotionally complex shows like The Sopranos, which centered on brutal mob boss Tony Soprano, a ruthless killer who intimidated everyone around him, but also portrayed him as a deeply troubled man who had recurring panic attacks and who had to battle his own anxiety and self-doubt when he turned to a woman therapist for help.
Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do. See, what they didn't know was once they got Gary Cooper in touch with his feelings, that they wouldn't be able to shut him up.
And then it's dysfunction this, and dysfunction that, and dysfunction...
And then there's Good Will Hunting, which catapulted Matt Damon to fame, with Damon playing the role of an intellectually gifted working-class tough guy who relieves the trauma of his abusive childhood by hardening himself to the world and fighting anyone who challenges him. With the support of a woman who loves him and a therapist he comes to trust, finds the courage to battle through his defenses, look inside himself, and let go of his bottled-up rage. After the Newtown Massacre, there was a lot of tough guy talk about how the cure for our violence problem is yet more violence.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
But there were other men who spoke in the wake of Newtown as well. Men like Neil Heslin, whose six-year-old son, Jesse, was among the 20 children gunned down that tragic day.
He was my son, he was my buddy, he was my best friend.
What was so important about his testimony was that he went beyond expressing grief for his son and directly challenged the culture of violence. Too often we define masculine strength by who can blow away the most people, who can flex the most muscle, who can impose their will and inflict the most damage. But this cheapens the real definition of strength and toughness. We respect the toughness of firefighters who rush into burning buildings when others are rushing out, police officers and other first responders who put their lives on the line, not because they're out to prove something, but because they steel themselves in the face of danger and face down their fears in service to others. For the same reason, we should respect the toughness and strength of men who challenge the myth that being a real man requires putting up a false front, disrespecting others, and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Strength is about adapting to change, not about retreating from it and lashing back with violence out of fear. And it's high time we had a definition of manhood capable of meeting that challenge.
While the program helped to diagnose the root causes of America's increasing levels of hypermasculinity, bullying, and gun violence, as well as the correlation between violence and manhood. But it seems that changing this culture, which is rooted so deeply in grotesque models of violence, is easier said than done. That's it for this week. Do join us next week here on Aperture. Until another Aperture, it's goodbye.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. The first International New Horizon Conference was held in 2012 and focused on having a creative hub where academics, artists, politicians, activists, and others could cooperate on discussing various global topics and searching for a solution, from the issue of Palestine to Hollywood to the situation of Black Americans in the United States. The conference held vibrant discussions and served as an effective forum to have these discussions. Well, the conference host is filmmaker and Iranian TV personality Nader Talibzadeh. In 2019, the New Horizon Conference, Mr. Talibzadeh and others who had organized the conference were sanctioned by the United States. Even the FBI approached some of the American participants and warned them of dire consequences if they attended the event. I will be talking to some of the speakers from the conference on this debate. Stay with us, please. But I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate, author and former diplomat Michael Springman, out of Washington, D.C., editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, out of Madison, and editor-in-chief of American Herald Tribune, Anthony Hall, out of Lethbridge, Alberta, Canada. Thank you all for being with us, and welcome to the program. Well, let's start it off with Michael. Michael, in your perspective, what were the overall goals of the New Horizon Conference? Because, of course, it's been accused of a range of things by the FBI, by the Department of Treasury in the United States. Your experience, in your perspective, with what you saw and experienced, what do you think the overall goals were?
Well, the goals, specifically at the conference I was at to talk about Palestine, however, I think the principal goal was to bring together a group of people from all over the world with different backgrounds and different skills and abilities to meet and talk together and try and come to an understanding and produce a common program for change. When I was at the conference, I sat next to an Arab journalist and a woman who had been to the first Gaza relief expedition, the only one that the Zionists didn't attack. There were people there who had formerly been with the Central Intelligence Agency. There were Hungarian politicians, Serbian journalists. It was a group of people from, including German politicians, along with a rabbi, David Weiss from New York City, and Nico Peled, an Israeli-American. It was a tremendously disparate group of people who shared a common goal in trying to make the world better. And of course, Sigal Pearl Mandukler, the Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, put a stop to that by sanctioning the conference, the management, and threatening all sorts of horrible actions to anyone who dared to go into any other conference organized by the New Horizon people.
Okay, well, I'm going to get to that
part. In my
part.
View, it was the grandest adventure of my life.
Stay with me, Michael. I'm going to get to that part in the second question, but I want to get each of my guests' a perspective on their experiences at the conference. Kevin, your take, what did you find? What did you experience at the New Horizon Conference that you participated in?
Well, it was almost like a kind of international summit for alternative media and alternative intellectuals, people who, for one reason or another, have been blacklisted in the West and who are looking into the issues that are completely taboo in Western media and the academy. And, of course, these are in many ways the most important issues. So it was really like going to a kind of a summit with a lot of the people that I'd admired and hadn't gotten to know in person before. I'd only known them through the Internet, and then getting to actually meet them was fantastic. And I think it's interesting that some of the most important and groundbreaking thinkers in the West have to go to Tehran to meet. That's why we had Dr. E. Michael Jones calling Tehran the capital of the free world, because the so-called free world is not so free these days. And you know, features, we're not talking about people from a particular ideological tendency. We've had everybody from the pretty far left mainstream, like Senator Mike Gravel, one of the great heroes of the anti-Vietnam War movement, one of the heroes of the Democratic Party, later the Libertarian and Green parties. And then we've also had people on the right, like Dr. Jones, among many others. So it was very well balanced in terms of different worldviews and perspectives, and yet everyone there is facing certain issues truthfully, and these are the issues that you're just not able to face truthfully in the United States of hypocrisy, and in the equally hypocritical states of Europe these days. So it's here in the United States, it feels rather ironic that in this land of freedom with the First Amendment, we have to go to Tehran to engage in free speech.
Okay, stay with me. What about that, Anthony? You heard what Kevin said, and we've heard this before, because I also was at a couple of the conferences, and I heard people actually say that they felt so free and being able to discuss issues that perhaps they could not have discussed in the United States. Your take and your experience.
Yes, of course, I did not appreciate how, I'm getting feedback with my earphones. I didn't appreciate how closed, how constrained the discussion was in North American academic circles until I went in 2014 to the New Horizon. Horizon conference in Tehran, and heard one was very, you know, interested to meet people from Iran and hear new perspectives in that respect, but also to meet Europeans from many parts of Europe, North Americans, basically people who use the English language in dissident positions in their own home turf. And so I was introduced and stretched, and my capacities were stretched to try to move along with the discussion and open myself up. Then after the meeting, what was surprising to me was the Anti-Defamation League, Ed Foxman, to hear these condemnations, these blanket condemnations of everybody at the conference as Holocaust deniers, as conspiracy theorists, as 9/11 truthers, all these weaponized terms used on steroids in a way. I was introduced to the kind of, I guess, big leagues of the polemics at the global level.
Well, going back to you, Michael, I mean, why would the United States have a problem with a forum and that most people would say it was quite dynamic and is quite dynamic, and allowing political perspectives across the gamut for people to sit down and discuss and talking about various problems and trying to come up with solutions and solidarity across the world? Why would this be problematic for Washington?
Well, it's problematic because Washington is controlled by the Zionists. Jews form 2% of the American population, yet they are controlling most of the foreign policy agencies in the Biden administration now. They are desperately afraid of free speech more and more in the United States, aside from the Zionist people. They don't want anything that contradicts the official line of American policy, whether you're dealing with the virus, whether you're dealing with September 11th, or whether you're dealing with the basics of American foreign policy. And in Iran, in Tehran, it was a freewheeling, open discussion of people with disparate backgrounds, disparate viewpoints, who yet got along, who respected each other. And this is something the United States doesn't want, because Iran, to it and its supporters in the apartheid entity that styles itself Israel, is that Iran is a dangerous, malign influence in the region and is building atomic bombs under every bed in the country, and they're going to use them all against Israel. So the whole idea of the United States objecting to any kind of freewheeling discussion in Iran is anathema, because it shows that Iran is a democratic country that permits opposing viewpoints, whatever that they might be.
Kevin, your perspective, when you look at, as far as the slogans that we hear all the time in the United States, and also, as Michael said, what is said about Iran, there's a 180-degree difference, it seems, from the reality. So people from the West were invited to the Islamic Republic of Iran to hold these dynamic discussions, but then the United States couldn't handle that. Do you think that this is a sign of a waning empire, that even it fears open discussions in an international forum?
Yes, I think the current crackdown on free speech, which has gone further and further in so many ways, and the ridiculous attack on New Horizon under false pretenses, is one aspect of this war on free speech, which is really a war against the founding principles of the American Republic, because there wouldn't have been any American Republic and American Constitution if the critics of the original version of the Constitution hadn't been able to get the Bill of Rights added. And the First Amendment is the heart of the Bill of Rights, and in many ways the heart of the Constitution. And you know, the U.S. is not an ethnic state. It doesn't have a deep history. It's not one people going back for millennia. It's a group of people from all over the world who are living together according to these Enlightenment principles, and free speech to free inquiry are right at the very. But today we're seeing that roll back in so many different ways, and I think that with the issue of who was trying to shut down New Horizon, it wasn't so much the realist American imperialist people. Remember, this was during the Obama administration, which followed the Bush-Cheney years with 9/11 and the so-called War on Terror, the Declaration Against the Axis of Evil, and so on. And then Obama was supposed to change that, and he did, to some extent, bring in a slightly different group of people who had less problem, really, with New Horizon than the neocons do. And so it wasn't the Obama administration that was trying to stop us from going to Iran. And on the contrary, I actually was treated quite respectfully every time I went. I had only one interrogation on the way back from Iran after going to New Horizon conferences almost every year from 2013 on. And that interrogation was just a minute and a half friendly conversation, really. So I think things really came to a head there sort of towards the end of the Obama administration, and then with the Trump administration, as the neocons turned things around. And their main concern is the state of Israel and the power of the Zionist lobby in the world and in the West. And I think they're terrified that American intellectuals will see eye to eye with Canadians like Dr. Hall, or with Europeans, and with Russians, and with Iranians, especially, and recognize that U.S. policy in the Middle East is not benefiting the U.S. at all. It's actually shooting the U.S. in the foot. We've wasted $7 trillion on these post-9/11 wars for Israel. So the pound free speech around New Horizons, as Mike Springman says, were basically Israel people, lobbyists and so on, the Anti-Defamation League. And then when the Obama administration gave way to the Trump administration and the Zionists or neocon Zionists came back into power, they're totally banned Americans from going to any New Horizon conferences under penalty of going to prison when you come back from Lebanon or Iran or what have you. This is really about protecting Israel and protecting Israel's power over the United States. Mm-hmm. And if ordinary Americans could see that this war on America and the war on America's First Amendment is being waged on behalf of an extremely hostile foreign entity, the State of Israel, that has repeatedly attacked the U.S. in false flag terrorism, from Operation Susanna in the 50s to the Liberty Incident in 1967 to the controlled demolition of the Trade Center on September 11, 2001. Americans essentially declare war on Israel. And the issue, the elephant in the room, it was Zionists who had to try to put a stop to Americans and Iranians having dialogue and trying to figure out what's really going on.
Okay. Well, Anthony, your take. You heard what Kevin said. I want to look at that because with what happened to New Horizon Conference and the organizers of the New Horizon Conference basically being sanctioned, trying to the United States to shut them down, perhaps an average American, if they heard this story, didn't feel that it affected them. But as the old saying goes, and then they came for me, because if we fast forward now to 2021 in the United States, and we see how censorship continues to get worse and worse inside of the country, how alternative perspectives and even which some perspectives which was once considered mainstream are being shut down and controlled. I want your perspective about that, because perhaps many Americans did not speak out for the sanctions against Iran in general and against, for example, like a New Horizon conference. Has that backfired now?
Well, we could see a sign of trouble on the horizon in 2019 at Beirut when I attended the New Horizon conference, the last one. Kevin and Michael Springman couldn't go to that one. The U.S. people were kept out. And then came the year 2020, a year of enormous divisiveness in the United States between the people who supported Trump, the so-called deplorables, and the Biden group, which had a tremendous alliance of power behind it. But even at the height of all of this crisis in 2020, the one thing that both sides seemed to be able to agree upon was that Iran is the biggest enemy. And the propaganda and pressure kept coming from Israel to these wars for Israel. The sort of penultimate one would be the invasion of Iran, which has been pushed for and pushed for and pushed for. And I think even now, with all that's happened, Americans have a hard time to see that the invisibility of this Israel lobby, and it is kept behind walls and barriers and censorship, this unity to support Israel and point towards this sort of ultimate goal of invading and doing regime change in Iran. This is so consistent, and we have very little testimony on mainstream media about this. And it is the most destabilizing force in the world, really.
Well, Michael, you just heard Anthony talk about Americans not being able to attend the conference in Beirut. What does that mean? Explain to our audience, as an American, when you're told that you're not allowed to travel somewhere and participate in the conference, tell us what happened.
Well, I frankly was outraged at this. The whole issue of sanctions is being run by a Zionist-controlled Office of Foreign Assets Control that goes back to 1950 and Harry Truman and China and the Korean War. The issue, of course, is it limited my freedom to travel. It's a basic constitutional right that the Supreme Court has held any number of decisions about and stating in unequivocally that Americans are free to travel wherever they want. Yet the executive branch of the government forbids travel to Cuba, it forbids travel to Venezuela, it forbids travel to Iran except under special circumstances. And of course, if you are going to attend a conference that's being promoted by a group that's been sanctioned by the Treasury Department, you are subject to astonishing fines and prison term. And the conference sounded very interesting. I knew people who were going. They were who I knew by reputation and would love to have met in person. And since I went to the one 3 years ago now, I would have loved to have gone back and met a number of people that I might have not met before, or new people that I could make acquaintance with and renew old relationships. So it's it personally harmed me. And I think it harmed the everyone's view of the United States, that only non-Americans might be able to go to a conference that supposedly is based on free exchange and fair exchange of ideas and viewpoints, and that the people involved are able to speak their minds no matter what they say, where they say it, or where they're from. And it goes against everything the United States stands for and was ever built upon and ever hopes to be.
Kevin, can you tell our viewers exactly what happened? Did you have a visit from the FBI? OFAC gave you information. Tell us how the information was transferred to you that you should not travel or participate in the conference that was going to be held in Lebanon.
Well, first I heard from some friends of mine, Sandra Hicks and indeed Mike Springman were among them, who had actually had visits or contacts from the FBI about this, and then my phone rang shortly thereafter, and it was the local FBI guy from Madison, Wisconsin, and he wanted to try to set up an interview with me, and he said it was about New Horizon, and we had a brief conversation, and I admitted to him, yes, I understand that you're telling me I can't go to the New Horizon conference or I'll be arrested on the way back. He agreed with that, so that was he confirmed that information, which I'd already heard from other people who'd actually had the FBI at their doorsteps early in the morning. But in my case, it was fortunately just this phone call, and so I said, "Yes, I'll sit down and talk with you about this because I have no secrets. I think everybody needs to hear about this, but I need to record it because I don't want to be misrepresented." And so he checked with the superior, and they said, "No, the FBI will not allow you to record the conversation with the FBI."
I think we're having some technical problems there with Kevin. What about you, Anthony? I mean, you're a Canadian, so were you not told not to attend the conference? Did you have any problems? Because I understand that you did go to Lebanon. Did you have any problems when you returned?
No, I didn't. I never have. I've always just come straight back into Canada, and I've never been interrogated in any way on what happens to me on the trip.
Let's talk about the conference in Lebanon that the United States was so afraid of. Anthony, tell us about the conference. What was taking place there that Washington feared so much?
Well, it was quite something to be having a New Horizon conference on the shores of the Mediterranean. And I think the reality is that since 2014, when I went to my first New Horizon conference, and 2019, the influence of Iran has expanded westward. And, you know, Iran has been exercising a certain amount of widened influence. And so obviously that seemed to be frightening the United States, the fact that this was taking, the U.S. government, the fact that this was taking place in Lebanon. And it was fascinating for me to go up to the border of Israel, for instance, at the Iranian park on the border of Israel in Lebanon. I wasn't aware of such a thing. It was fascinating to get to know Hezbollah, to meet people in it, and find that, you know, it's every sort of grandmother and child, and, you know, it's the entire society in the south of Lebanon might be considered Hezbollah. It was eye-opening in many ways. And what was also eye-opening was the fact that the U.S. government has become so petrified of allowing discourse and free exchange of ideas in the type of milieu that we've developed and cultivated at New Horizons, that the U.S. Was showing itself and taking such a repressive act, which of course is now becoming commonplace as the Biden group prepared to define all the basic Trump supporters, I guess you could say the deplorables, as domestic terrorists. So much of this injustice and prevention of due process, free speech, and innocent until proven guilty goes forward in the name of terrorism. Now it seems that the U.S. has become so conversant with using this technique to repress people that it's about to do it on its own citizens, on a huge swath of its own citizens.
And hopefully you guys will continue to be somewhat free to talk about the reality here in Iran. I appreciate all of you being with me for this program looking at the New Horizon Conference. Author and former diplomat Michael Springman out of Washington, D.C. Editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett out of Madison, and editor-in-chief of American Herald Tribune, Anthony Hall out of Lethbridge. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself right here in Tehran, and all the crew.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.